So nice to be with you all. Nice to have some time together, explore a little bit. I just finished teaching the last retreat of a program called Heavenly Messengers. It was a 2-year program that Veronica was participating in. And we had our final retreat a week or so ago. And as part of that retreat, my friend Joan Halifax taught. And Joan is a kind of no-nonsense woman. She's a fierce force of nature. And at one point, it was a Skype call like this, and a student came and started asking her a question or sharing with her some of her experience. And the experience was that she works in a prison, and that when she comes home from the prison, she's sometimes tired or a little bit exhausted from not only the work, but the impossibility of the situation that she finds herself in, the adversarial nature of our prison systems. And Joan listened very carefully, and then she said something really simple to the woman. She said, "What are you going to do about it?" And it was great. You know, she didn't say, "Oh, poor baby, I'm sorry it's so hard for you." She said, "What are you going to do about it?" And I like that. And I thought to myself, you know, we are regularly, all the time, we're faced with impossible situations. What are we going to do about it? You know, there's an old Zen story where a student comes to her dying teacher, and she says to her teacher, what's the pith teaching? What's one teaching that encapsulates your entire life? And the teacher said, "An appropriate response. An appropriate response. Now, in this practice, we've been discovering there's no one-size-fits-all. Everybody enters the practice differently. They express it differently. They learn differently. There's no one teaching that applies to everybody. You know, you remember that sometimes the Dhamma was spoken about, the metaphor was that it was like medicine. And so it would be kind of absurd to ask, what's the best medicine, wouldn't it? Without really knowing what the cause of the illness was or the nature of the illness. It would be silly to ask, what's the best medicine? So in a similar way, it would be similar to ask, what's the best Dharma practice? It depends on your life. It depends on the conditions of your life. So we need to draw from the wisdom that the practice shows us, but also from our accumulated experience over the years. And I think from something deeper than that. And that's something I would call our own innate goodness. Each of us has this, our innate goodness. We're not always in contact with it. It's difficult to find sometimes. But that's where the appropriate response comes from. As human beings, we are often, not just once in a while, but often, asked to face the impossible. This week, we watched it in Paris. We watched it a few weeks ago in Beirut. How do we respond to this? How do we meet this? It's impossible. Yeah? Are you hearing me okay? Yeah? So, you know, when people were asking me, what should we do about, you know, this experience in Paris? And when I, you know, tried to ask myself that, what should I do about it? You know, it was impossible. I mean, what do we do when our heart's torn apart, you know, by grief, or it's consumed in rage? What do we do when our mind is swept away in disbelief or confusion? What do we do when, you know, rejection and fear is rippling through our bodies? It's impossible. So for me, all I know how to do is to stop, pause, and first to turn toward my experience. That's the only place I know how to begin. So I you know, turn toward my experience and my resistance to my experience, because that's often part of it. I don't want to feel what's there. So I turn toward that resistance with some tenderness, with some mercy. And then with applying that tenderness, applying that mercy, I cultivate kindness, strength, equanimity that might allow me to turn toward those other parts of myself or others that are terribly ugly and I don't want to see and I want to run away from. And maybe after I do that for a little while, then I can really start to think about, well, what's the best medicine here? How do I stand in a steady way against injustice? How do I respond? And we had a woman in this retreat, this Heavenly Messengers retreat. Her name is Christy. And she's a woman with very serious cancer right now. And we asked her if she couldn't come, and so we Skyped her in, kind of like this. And we asked her what she was learning from her illness. And she wrote us a letter. And I want to read you just a small part of it. She said, "With this cancer, I now have to give up the notion of life on my own terms. With this cancer, I cannot go where I want to go and do what I want to do. My body is in charge. And it's not mind over matter. There's only the interaction between mind and matter and environment, each affecting each other in profound ways. I trust in my absolute belief that the body is built this way on purpose. It's designed to fail." I love that she said that. And she said, "And I'm built this way, and because I am, I know that loss is inevitable. But it's also true that I'm built to handle these losses. That must also be true. If I'm built to experience these losses, I must also be built to handle these losses. And part of my nature is to experience them as they are right now." And then she says, "I'm not unique. I believe that being sick is not special. It happens to everybody at some point. The only mystery is when. The suffering really is universal, and I'm not alone in it. I also trust that I can find joy, even though this body and this world are made of pain and suffering." Beautiful, I thought. Can you imagine if we could meet our cancer in that way, or meet the troubles of the world in that way? And what allows her to do that? Well, for me, I think she draws on something deeper than just her acquired experience, deeper than just her little intelligence or her preference about how things go. I think she draws on some basic goodness. And I think we can rely on this, and I think we need to rely on it in times that are crazy, like the world, like what's happening in the world right now. Our wise hearts, they're reliable guides. And they help us, as the Buddha taught, to go against the grain. When the whole culture is moving in a particular direction, this practice helps us go against the grain. It helps us go toward the suffering, as opposed to being swept away by it. I was listening to a beautiful talk by Parker Palmer. Some of you know his work, Parker Palmer. And he was just giving the keynote address at the graduation at Naropa Institute. It'd be worth to go and find it, you know. It was really good. And he had several points that he offered, but one of them was, welcome whatever you find alien in yourself. I thought that was a great piece of advice. Welcome whatever you find alien within yourself and extend that same welcome to whatever you find alien in the outer world. Sounds like somebody once said, welcome everything, push away nothing. Then his team went on and he said a beautiful thing that I really agree with. He said, violence is what happens when we don't know what else to do with our suffering. Violence is what happens when we don't know what else to do with our suffering. I thought that was really powerful. You know, sometimes we aim that violence at ourselves. And it happens. We do it every day. We overwork. We take on too many projects. We drive ourselves crazy with some kind of, you know, notion about what we're supposed to get done today or this year or in this lifetime. Does that sound familiar to anybody? Or sometimes we aim this violence at other people. And it takes the form of racism or homophobia or Islamophobia. The good news is that our suffering can be transformed. If we have it, we are built. If it's true that we are built for loss, it's also true that we are built to work with that loss, to work with that suffering. My friend Norman Fisher, he was also talking at this retreat, and he said something beautiful. He said, spiritual practice is less about a solitary visionary experience and more about human relationship. Awakening is not the fruit of some isolated practice, but of connection. You know, there's a beautiful teaching, what's called the Bodhisattva Vow, and it's translated in different ways, but one way that it's translated is, beings are numberless, I vow to liberate them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to transform them. Reality is boundless, I vow to perceive it. The awakened way is unsurpassable, I vow to embody it. How do we do that? It's impossible. How do we save all beings, you know? How do we do that? How do we liberate everybody? It's impossible. You know, after my heart attacks, after the second surgery, it had been 8 months of recovery, and I was wiped out, and I was tired and exhausted and frustrated and a little depressed. So I went and I was doing a one-day sitting with my friend Norman, who's not my teacher, but he's a dear friend. And I wanted to see him, and so I did Dokusan, an interview with him. And you know, I came in and I said, Norman, all this stuff we've been talking about, telling people to prepare for their dying, it's crap. It's crap. You can't prepare for it. I tried. It didn't work, you know. And he said, oh, Frank, but you've spent your whole life doing this. You know, you can't give up on it that easy. I said, oh, it's nonsense. Stop telling people that you can do it. Stop telling them that this practice makes a damn bit of difference. So I said to Norman. That's really how I felt at the time, you know. And he kept trying to persuade me otherwise. And I said, I just wouldn't hear it. You know, I was really honest. Boom. And then Norman turned to me. His best friend had died just a few weeks before. And he turned to me and he said, Frank, please don't die. I couldn't afford to lose another friend. And that cut through. That really cut through. And he said, I don't know what to say. He said, the only thing I know how to do when we come up against the impossible is make a vow. And so that's what those bodhisattva vows are that I just recited for you. Beings are numberless. I vow to liberate them. How do we do that? Well, we make a vow. And we know in a certain way it's impossible, but we do it anyway. We do it anyway. Not because we're confused or we like hopeless cases. It's because we know we can't really be free until everybody is. That's the relational part. So I went back to my cushion that day, and I sat down on my cushion. I thought, what vow can I make? You know. And I made this vow that day. I vow to live as long as possible so that I might love and serve. That was my vow. to live as long as possible so that I might love and serve. And most every day I repeat that vow. Some days I forget, but I try to remember. It's impossible. What are you going to do about it? It's impossible. Let's acknowledge that. What are you going to do about it? You know, the Buddha, after he had this great enlightening experience sitting under the Bodhi tree, you know, the story goes that he sat there for 8 weeks after he was enlightened. 8 weeks. And here was this newly enlightened Buddha under the Bodhi tree, but he didn't decide to teach the Dharma. He didn't. He thought, no one's going to understand this, what I understood. He said, it's not going to happen. So he just sat there. And then, you know, this Deva, Brahma Samapati, as his name was, Brahma Samapati, he was in the heaven realm, you know, and he saw this. And he could kind of read the Buddha's mind in this magical way. And he said, the world will be lost, utterly perish, since the Buddha inclines toward inaction. That's what Brahma Samapati said. And so he appeared before the Buddha in this magical way, and he knelt down before the Buddha on one knee, and he paid homage to him. And then he said, in the text it says, O exalted one, preach the Dhamma. There are some beings with a little dust in their eye that are wasting away from not hearing the Dharma, and there will be those who will understand. In other words, he said to the Buddha, it's impossible. What are you going to do about it? And the Buddha looked around with his all-seeing Buddha eyes, and he looked over the whole world, and he realized, oh, there are some people who would understand. They live in Sandpoint, and I should, you know, they'll be coming, they'll be getting born, and I should teach for them. And so, you know, he announced, he said this beautiful thing. It says, open the doors to the deathless. That's what the Buddha said. Open the doors to the deathless. And that gift, that teaching has come down, you know, through the centuries to this day, to this moment, to tonight. Joan Halifax had just come back from trekking through the Himalayas, where she leads a clinic of about 30 healthcare people and others who bring medicines and medical treatment to very rural areas of Nepal, where there is nothing, you know, not literally nothing. And you know, when you see someone like that, and she's a dear friend, it can be a little intimidating, because you can say, okay, well, she's doing something remarkable. What do I do? You know, we can think that our actions have little value. But I don't agree. I think when Peter orients new people into our Sangha, at the door there, that's service. I think when Anna takes on the thankless job of doing the accounting for the Sangha, that's service. I think when Linda, sitting there, accepts the task of teaching when she doesn't want to, when she was feeling like, I don't want to do that, that's service. When the whole Sangha wrapped their arms around Wendy after Bob's death, that's service. You know, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, since the time he was born, somebody has been saying to him, you are the embodiment of compassion. Can you imagine if somebody had said that to us your whole life? It kind of worked out for him, you know? And I thought about this, you know, I thought, wow, you know, since he was born, people have been telling him this. Now, you know, as you know, I'm a new grandpa. So I'm trying it out, you know? I'm trying it out with my granddaughter. She was here yesterday. I was babysitting her, and I kept saying to her, you are nothing but love. You are the embodiment of love. Yeah, I don't know. I'll let you know how it works out.
you know, we're just one being, one big being. And, you know, when we have a thorn on our foot, the hand reaches down and pulls out the thorn. And it doesn't make a big deal about it. It just does what it can. That's what hands can do. They can pull out thorns. So just as you have cells in your body, just as you have, you know, various organs in your body that all work together to make one harmonious entity, all life on Earth works that way. Everything. One whole thing. And the more we're open to this, the more we're willing to love and to serve. It comes from the recognition that we're one being. And, you know, by helping the other person, you're actually helping yourself. By helping the other person, you're actually helping yourself. But not in the usual sense that we think about it. You know, so when I say that, some of you might think, oh yeah, by helping others, I cultivate this certain quality of generosity, or I, you know, develop unselfishness, and that's good for my practice and good to be in the world. And that's true, but that's not what I'm talking about. It means something different than that. I'm not saying that you're helping yourself in terms of your own development. I'm saying you're helping yourself directly. You're literally helping yourself. It's like when your left hand gets hurt, your right hand immediately takes care of it. It doesn't think about it. So when we serve each other, we help ourselves. It's that you're inside the other. It's a kind of inversion. You and the other are both helped at the same time. And the more that understanding gets stabilized, the more it gets realized, the more mature we become, then the more invisible we become. And it's not because, you know, we don't count or that we're not valuable. It means we become transparent and our service becomes transparent. I was showing a film of my old mentor, Stephen Levine, at this retreat I was just teaching. And Stephen likened doing hospice work or service as being a conscious gas station attendant. That's what he said. He said, you're a conscious gas station attendant when you're doing service. He said, somebody comes in and they ask for gas, you give them gas. And when he asks for oil, you give him oil. And when he asks for their tires to be filled with air, you give him air. You don't say, Om Mani Padme Hum. You know, when somebody needs help, you don't say, well, let me read to you from the Tibetan Book of the Dead. You get them soup. You know? And it's not that soup is any less important than reading from the Tibetan Book of the Dead. It's the same thing. It's the same thing. And when you get them soup, you're feeding yourself. That's how it is. And when we understand that, you know, we don't want to do harm to others. We don't want to create more harm where there's already been enough harm. We don't want to add to that. We might need to stand up against injustice, but we do that not from some adversarial place, but from some place that recognizes what's true. That when people don't know what to do with their suffering, they become violent. When we see that they're suffering, we have a different relationship to them. It's not Pollyanna. It's not warm and fuzzy. It's just true. It's just true. And it won't be easy. It will be impossible. It will be totally impossible. What are you going to do about it? So that's my thoughts for tonight. I don't know if any of it rings true for you or is helpful for you, but that's the best I could do. So let's take some time now to talk about it. See what we can understand together. Don't just take my word for this. Let's see what we can really understand together. Hang on, I'll just pause this recording.